tonight on PBS News Weekend. Turkey votes to pick their next leader as the world waits to see if President Erdogan can hold on after two decades in power. Then a look at the misdiagnosis and unequal treatment of women with Parkinson's disease. And some never-before-seen celestial events thrilling scientists and space enthusiasts alike.
It's a reminder that we are pretty insignificant in the grand scheme of things, and yet we've gotten pretty smart at figuring some big things out.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. In Turkey, officials are counting the votes from today's election to see if President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will continue his two-decade hold on power. The state-run news agency indicates that Erdogan may be headed for a runoff in 2 weeks. The election, with a unified opposition, represented the greatest political challenge yet to Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian rule. The challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, narrowly led Erdogan in pre-election surveys. He's a retired civil servant and ran on the promise of restoring democracy, which Erdogan had eroded. Some Turkish voters went to the polls today in mood for change.
For me, this feels like a parting of ways. I don't know how to describe it. I can't think of a more important election.
While we await the final vote count, we turn to Sonar Çaptay, who's head of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His most recent book is A Sultan in Autumn, Erdogan Faces Turkey's Uncontainable Forces. To use your terms, what are the uncontainable forces that are driving Erdogan to a runoff tonight?
I would say that economy is his Achilles heel. Erdogan has won elections until recently on a platform of strong economic growth. And he's never won elections while not delivering growth. At the same time, he came pretty close to clinching victory this time. So economy was a big factor going into the elections for him. And the earthquake should have hurt his popularity. Aid agencies were nowhere to deliver aid after this devastating and sad earthquake. But his strength is his information control, or control of information flow, rather. In the last half a decade, Erdogan has eliminated autonomy of many of Turkey's institutions, from courts to foreign ministry to the central bank, with grave ramifications for country's economy, foreign policy, but also electoral boards and media. 90% of the media is aligned with him, and 80% of Turkey's citizens cannot read languages other than Turkish. So he can curate reality. And in the run-up to these elections, citizens did not hear about inflation, human rights abuses, journalists and politicians in jail, or relief agencies that failed to provide aid after the earthquake, but how Erdogan has made Turkey a great military industrial power. He repeated this argument over and over in the media, given that a large majority of citizens basically read the news that he curated. So I think this is the first election won in the world, Erdogan being the inventor of nativist populist politics in this century globally, the first election won on a platform of post-truth narrative, meaning you spread lies, you repeat them so much that they become reality, and you win elections based on that, and people forgot that these were lies to begin with.
This election is being closely watched in Western capitals, here in Washington, at the Kremlin. Why? What's at stake for those parties?
A lot is at stake. Turkey is the second largest military in NATO. It borders Iran, Iraq, Syria. It plays a role in the war in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin decided last year that he wanted Erdogan to win. As the economy in Turkey went into problems and hyperinflation under Erdogan, large amounts of cash was transferred from Russia to Turkey. Erdogan handed these out in the form of very generous social security benefits, as well as cheap natural gas from Russia that he basically gave free to voters in the run-up to elections. And I think that helped perhaps put him close to the finishing line. Putin wants Erdogan to win because Erdogan is a like-minded leader that helps Putin challenge the U.S.-led liberal international order. So I think Putin is quite happy tonight that Erdogan did not lose. We have a runoff likely in 2 weeks, and Putin will continue to support Erdogan financially and through information operations because he cannot afford to see Erdogan lose when he's not winning himself in Ukraine.
And tell us about the opponent he's going to face in the runoff, Kılıçdaroğlu. How much of his strength tonight is support for him? How much is opposition to Erdogan?
Absolutely. Kılıçdaroğlu is a soft-spoken politician, opposite of Erdogan. Erdogan is a populist. He demonizes and brutalizes and cracks down on demographics unlikely to vote for him. Kılıçdaroğlu followed a campaign where he reached out across the aisle, tried to bridge Turkey's traditional left-right split, him being on the left side, of course. And perhaps it worked. He was able to unite opposition forces, but he couldn't really get to, I think, the 50% margin. And in this regard, I think Erdogan played a really masterful game. Kılıçdaroğlu's party was supported by a pro-Kurdish faction. Erdogan branded this faction as quote-unquote terrorists. And as I said, post-truth narrative. If you repeat a lie enough many times, it becomes reality. I think some voters were convinced that support for Kılıçdaroğlu by this opposition Kurdish party meant support by terrorist factions, and he probably lost some support as a result of that.
If Erdogan wins the runoff, or if it goes to the runoff and Erdogan wins the runoff, do you think his assault on democracy will continue?
I have so far argued that Turkey is a, you know, countries could be vegetables. I've said that Turkey is the onion. Why the analytically onion? Because it doesn't have a core. You peel it, you think you got to the core, and it's not there. So taking that analogy, I always argued that Turkey is not an autocracy, not a democracy. It is a democracy that has fallen under an autocrat. It's trying to make a comeback. It didn't succeed quite. We'll see in the runoff what happens. If Erdogan wins again, I think Turkey will become a complete autocracy. The remaining institutions that have maintained their autonomy will fold under him, the few courts and others. The last vestiges of rule of law will disappear. Erdogan will become anointed as the country's new sultan. Educated Turks and youth will flee the country, having up any, given up any hope, that lost hope that he can be voted out. And I think that, unfortunately, Turkey will descend into deeper autocracy.
Soner Çaptay, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Elsewhere, tropical cyclone Mocha made landfall over Myanmar today, battering the coast with heavy rain and winds up to 130 miles an hour. The storm lashed the sprawling Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh, but the country was spared a direct hit. So far, officials report three casualties, all in Myanmar to the east. In recent days, hundreds of thousands of people in Myanmar and Bangladesh were moved to safer areas and sturdier structures. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's diplomatic tour of European allies took him to Berlin today. He told reporters there that the goal of a planned counteroffensive is to drive Russian forces out of Ukrainian territory they occupy, not to attack Russia. He spoke at a news conference with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and disputed a report that said leaked U.S. intelligence documents suggested he'd consider trying to capture Russian territory as bargaining chips in peace talks.
We do not attack Russian territory. We liberate our lawful land. We are not interested in this. We don't have time for this. We don't have powers for this.
Zelensky has already arrived at his next stop, Paris, for talks with French President Emmanuel Macron. And Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said today the number of people crossing the Mexico border illegally was cut in half since the pandemic-era immigration policy known as Title 42 ended at midnight Thursday. Mayorkas said Border Patrol agents encountered more than 10,000 people entering the country illegally in the days leading up to Title 42's expiration. But on Friday, there were just over 6,000 and just over 4,000 on Saturday. Illegal border crossings remain higher than in previous months and remain well above the lows during the pandemic. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the celestial events thrilling space scientists and enthusiasts, and the story of the first Indian American astronaut who gave her life exploring space.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour. Weeknights on PBS.
After Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's is the second most common neurodegenerative disorder in the United States. It's a diagnosis nearly 90,000 Americans get every year. But as Ali Rogan tells us, it exhibits its symptoms differently in women than in men.
Parkinson's disease damages or kills nerves in the brain, causing muscle stiffness, tremors, and other symptoms that worsen over time. And while it's more common in men than women, women are more often misdiagnosed or diagnosed late. And sometimes women experience symptoms and respond to treatment differently than men. Joining me to discuss is Sonia Mather, a Parkinson's disease advocate and family physician. Dr. Mather, thank you so much for joining us. As you've described it, to me, Parkinson's disease is really more of a spectrum of neurodegenerative disorders more than any one ailment. So with the understanding that it's not a monolith, can you describe what some of the most common symptoms of Parkinson's disease are?
Parkinson's disease is the second most common neurological disease behind dementia, but it's the fastest growing of the neurological illnesses. And it, as you mentioned, is neurodegenerative, progressive, relentless, without a cure. And the symptoms can sort of be divided into two groups. The motor symptoms, those are things like tremor and slowness of movement and stiffness and falls. Non-motor symptoms can be anything from head to toe, including hair and skin changes, fatigue, sleep issues, constipation, a variety of symptoms.
How is it that men and women experience these symptoms differently?
Women are more tremor dominant. We have more facial masking and more restless leg syndrome. When it comes to non-motor symptoms, we tend to suffer more from mood issues such as anxiety and depression and sleep disturbances compared to our male counterparts. We also experience more fatigue, pain, and urogenital symptoms such as urinary dysfunction and incontinence. And what's even more is that we know that the severity and impact of these symptoms varies according to the hormonal status of the woman, for example, throughout her menstrual cycle or with menopause, for example. We believe that the longer that you're exposed to estrogen through your life, that that may help to prevent or to protect you from getting something like Parkinson's disease. But we just don't have the answers. Historically, most research participants were white, older gentlemen. So a lot of our treatment guidelines that came from that research were based on a result of a small set of a population that's actually affected by this disease, because the stereotype is still there today that it affects white older gentlemen, as opposed to the fact that this disease really knows no boundaries in terms of age, gender, race, geographical borders.
And you yourself were diagnosed with what's known as young onset Parkinson's at age 28. What was that experience like for you getting diagnosed, and how did you come to understand that that's what you had?
I basically noticed an intermittent tremor in my right pinky finger. I just completed my residency in family medicine, was expecting my first daughter. And my husband, who's also a physician, said I had better go get it checked out. And instead of getting the news that I had hoped, I was instead diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's disease at the age of 28. And that was almost 24 years ago. And the disease continued to progress, so much so that I had to actually stop my clinical medical practice, unfortunately. And instead, I've devoted my life towards advocacy, education, and research in Parkinson's disease. The impact of this disease is really extremely disabling. It affects you not only physically, but mentally, socially, emotionally, and relationships get affected. And it's pretty unpredictable in terms of its disability. Mm. Your symptoms and response to medication can really vary day by day, hour to hour, and that's sort of what I'm experiencing now as well.
And speaking of that unpredictability, are there any symptoms, any changes that women should look out for if they think potentially they may be experiencing Parkinson's disease symptoms?
The issue with young onset Parkinson's disease in general, and women in particular, is that we often present with non-specific symptoms. Mine was a little bit unusual in that I had the tremor right away. A lot of women will, or men for that matter, in young onset Parkinson's will present with, you know, shoulder pain or a slowness of movement, not swinging their arm, loss of smell, constipation, depression, what we call REM sleep behavior disorder, which is acting out your dreams and moving during sleep. And the other problem with diagnosing women or men in this younger age is the fact that not only are the symptoms nonspecific, but the physicians also are not of the mindset that this happens in younger people. They're still on the lookout for it in older people, and particularly men.
And to that point, are there any advancements in the study of this that give you hope?
It's definitely improving. Researchers are much more aware of the need to include underrepresented populations in general in their work. We need to do research that are inclusive of women and our unique genetics, our unique hormonal status. The research that is out there currently is lacking in these areas. For example, I mentioned that we think that there may be a neuroprotective role for estrogen. When it comes to the timing of estrogen exposure, when is it best to start something like hormone replacement therapy? What type of hormone replacement therapy and for how long? What about oral contraceptive pills? We know that women report that their Parkinson's symptoms tend to get worse just prior to menstruation, sometimes during it as well. What is the best way to manage those fluctuations? That's something we don't know yet. How does pregnancy affect the trajectory or progression of your Parkinson's, or does it? There's so many unanswered questions that affect women uniquely. And I want to always stress that this type of research is not only just important for women, but can benefit the whole Parkinson's community because it increases our general understanding or knowledge of this disease, which will benefit everybody. It's really a win-win situation that way.
Dr. Sonia Mathur, family physician and Parkinson's disease advocate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been an exciting time for astronomers, astrophysicists, and other scientists who specialize in the goings-on in the far reaches of space. Since the beginning of the month, observations of some never-before-seen celestial events have been reported in science journals. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien is here to explain all. Miles, thanks for joining us. The first one is a star swallowing up a planet that was orbiting around it. And as you talk about it, we're going to show some animation from Caltech depicting it.
Well, John, I don't want to ruin your weekend, but this is, in fact, a preview of what lies ahead for our little planet Earth. A team of researchers at Palomar Observatory outside San Diego were using a wide-field camera called the Zwicky Transient Facility, which looks at a big swath of the night sky looking for things like comets and asteroids. Astronomer Kishile Day at MIT was going through data from 2020. There's so much data that they have a backlog. And he noticed a star about 12,000 light years away that grew 100 times brighter over the course of a week. He thought maybe that was a binary star, which he studies quite a bit, two stars which kind of interact with each other and their brightness changes as the gravity pushes and pulls. But the problem was the total amount of energy that was released by this event was way less than it would be if it was two stars. And so that meant, by virtue of that it was probably a black hole swallowing up a planet. But it's not just any planet, 10 times bigger than Jupiter. And I guess the flash that he saw, I guess it amounts to a cosmic belch, John.
You say this is going to happen to Earth. Does this happen to all planets? Do they eventually sort of go into their suns?
Not all of them. Like the outer planets in our solar system are likely to be spared. And we're kind of on the bubble. We know Venus and Mercury, they're goners eventually. There's some scientific debate as to what will happen to us. But basically, the star gets bigger and bigger as it gets older, like we all do, I suppose, gets hotter and eventually gobbles up the near planets. So I'm sorry to give that piece of news to everybody here this weekend, but we have some time to plan.
You've given us a lot of lead time. The next thing I want to ask you about is the largest space explosion ever detected.
This one is very far away, 8 billion light years away. So that means what we're seeing in these images or animations or data is at about 6 billion years after the creation of the universe, the Big Bang. This explosion lasted about 3 years. So what was it? No one's really sure. The current thinking is that maybe the black hole in this case, much more powerful than ours, swallowed up a huge gas cloud and in so doing created this multi-year explosion. So again, the universe is a rough place, John.
Tough neighborhood. There's also a neutron star that is behaving in a way that scientists didn't think a star could behave. First of all, start out by telling us what a neutron star is.
It's like a dead star, didn't quite make it to black hole status, but a neutron star is a very, very dense object. There are limits to how bright they can become. It's called the Eddington limit. A little bit of physics here, but basically it's a push and pull between the light photons and gravity. And the physicists would tell you that given the size of any particular object, there's a limit to how bright it can be. But this one, turns out, is 100 to 500 times brighter beyond this so-called Eddington limit. And they think what's happening here is that the magnetic field at this particular neutron star is actually warping the atoms and allowing that star to hold together longer than it would otherwise. So that's a little bit mind-bending and actually literally atom-bending, but there you have it.
This is all mind-bending to me. The closest instance of a black hole tearing apart a star, remind us or describe what a black hole is, and we'll play some animation from NASA.
Yeah, these are huge gravity wells that are at the center of most galaxies. There's one at the center of ours. This one, they say, close in astronomical terms, it's 137 million light years away from Earth. And we know about these tidal disruption events, which create this thing, my favorite astronomical term, spaghettification. It pulls things in so rapidly that they stretch out spaghetti style. And this is the closest one we've seen. But as you look at this animation that NASA made for us, this is all a reminder of, number one, how far science has taken us to even understand all of this and the fact that we know this all exists. We have the Webb Space Telescope giving us great imagery. We have the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile coming online soon. All kinds of instruments which are going to take us even farther and further back in time. And, you know, to me, John, it's a reminder that we're pretty insignificant in the grand scheme of things. And yet we've gotten pretty smart at figuring some big things out. So as we face our problems here on Earth, we do have the capability of understanding big things. And maybe that's something we can take in our daily lives to help us understand how we solve smaller problems right here on Earth. That's my philosophical note for the weekend.
We appreciate it, Miles. This has been fascinating. Our own very own master of the universe, Miles O'Brien. Thank you very much.
John, it's a pleasure.
Finally tonight, our Hidden History series. We explore the legacy of the first Indian American astronaut who gave her life in the name of research, science, and exploration.
Dr. Kalpana Chawla, also a rookie mission specialist.
In 1997, Kalpana Chawla realized her lifelong dream of traveling to space. She was the first American of Indian descent to accomplish that feat. Once, it all seemed unimaginable.
For me, it was very far-fetched to think I'd get to fly on the space shuttle, because I lived in India in a very small town, and forget about space, I didn't even know if my folks were going to let me go to the engineering college.
She did get an aerospace engineering degree from Punjab Engineering College in India and a PhD from the University of Colorado Boulder. In 1994, she was one of the 20 applicants accepted in NASA's astronaut program out of a pool of nearly 4,000.
We do not see Spartan. We plan to re-grapple.
She was assigned to the Shuttle Columbia as a mission specialist and prime robotic arm operator. On her first mission, Chawla used the arm to deploy a research satellite. It was intended to study the sun, but malfunctioned. On her second mission, she oversaw research on the impact of low gravity, ranging from crystal growth to cancer. But on the return to Earth on February 1st, 2003, just minutes before it was to land in Florida, the Columbia disintegrated, killing the entire crew. NASA suspended space flights for 2 years while it investigated the disaster, which was blamed on damage the shuttle suffered at liftoff. In India, there was shock and horror. Many said tearful prayers at Chawla's hometown of Karnal.
And liftoff. The SS Kalpana Chawla takes flight, sights set on the International Space Station.
In 2020, NASA launched a commercial spacecraft named after the modest but determined woman who pursued her passion, inspired others, and contributed to the cutting edge of science.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Happy Mother's Day.